So tell me again, you had for breakfast?
I had oatmeal with pecans and raisins and dried cranberries.
Okay. Great. All right. Well, now we're going to ignore that thing.
Okay. All
right.
Sounds
good. You're sitting right in front of me. I'll be very casual here in the corner of your couch. Actually, this is a very nice couch.
Thank you.
I like the texture. So, would you mind saying your full name and your birth date and where you live?
Okay. My name is Audrey Nicolette. I don't like that middle name. Nicolette Petty, and my birth date is September 11th, 1967. And I live in Chicago.
What don't you like about your middle name?
It's so prissy. It doesn't feel like it has anything to do with me. But there it is, Nicolette. Yeah, I don't think I'll ever grow into it, but anyway.
What do you plan to do for your birthday? Anything special? It's coming up soon.
It is. I don't have any plans. I don't even know what day of the week it is. That will be a big factor, actually. If it's a weekend, then we'll be doing something with Ella and probably go to a museum, get outdoors. If it's a weekday, then I might go do something like get a massage and read a book that I've been meaning to read and then do something with Ella and Maurice. Have a nice dinner. But yeah, I gotta look at the calendar.
I'm gonna check this again because once I did an interview and I just wasn't even recording.
Yeah.
It was just moving because I was checking the sound, but it was never recording.
Okay.
So you mentioned Ella, that's your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about her name.
Her name is Ella Esther Ann Petty Rabb, and Ella came, it was inspired by three Ellas. I tend to think in threes because I think it's because I come from a three-sister family. So I had Ella Fitzgerald in mind, Ella Baker, the civil rights worker, and Ella Jenkins, who is a folk singer, who was a folk singer when I was a little kid and who made me, you know, my mom was a music teacher, a musician, but she played a lot of Ella Jenkins for us, and I really loved her. And she came to visit our preschool. So I had three Ellas. And then Esther is after my mom's sister, Esther, who was like my grandmother, because I didn't know my grandmother. So I got to know her pretty well over a good part of her life. And she was a really strong, fierce, smart, independent woman, thinker. So yeah, it was a way of paying tribute to her. She, by the time I had Ella, she passed away.
I was thinking about Ella because in that one piece you sent me, it's about her, you know, traveling with her. So
yeah.
I thought that was nice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's coming up a lot in my essays and stuff that just feels like urgent to me these days. So I think that was the first piece that I wrote about her. And it was when I was kind of coming out of the other side of like early parenthood where I felt like, oh, I can keep making stuff again. And so that it was a nice assignment to get.
I hadn't really known my grandparents either. So I was thinking about that.
You
a lot.
Didn't? Did
no.
you know them at all? Did you meet them or?
Well, when I was I guess I came to the United States with my parents when I was 11 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was born, I think one of my grandparents was still alive, but
mm-hmm.
they had all passed before
mm-hmm.
I was born. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even the one that I met, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
so small. Yeah.
That's my experience. No, my grandfather's were passed long before I was born, and then my grandmother's died when I was young. So, you know, the one I read about at DuSable was the one who lived the longest, and I hardly knew her. Mm. Yeah.
So, Why don't you tell me a little bit about the project you're working on right now? Just, you know, just as I'm curious about you and your life and who you are. And we have that story that you read. I actually taped that on that day.
Oh, good.
It's not like the best recording because it was kind of a big room.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to learn more about you,
mm-hmm.
and talk a little about what you've been working on now and what you worked on before. So
yeah, well, you know, I guess I'll start with the piece I read because
mm-hmm.
it's tied into a larger project that I am very slowly, steadily pursuing. And it came out of having an assignment, going to the Southern Foodways Symposium and going a few years and then being invited to write something 1 year for the theme that year. There's a theme, a different theme every year was race and food. And so I was told there was going to be a panel on iconic foods of iconic Southern foods, and that there might be someone talking about black-eyed peas or watermelon or macaroni and cheese. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write about chitlins, because when else am I going to write about chitlins? And I thought, if I were to write about chitlins, this would be the crowd that would understand what I'm talking about. And so I wrote it and I read it. This was maybe 5 or 6 years ago now. And it was so much fun to write it. And I wrote this essay all about me and my mom, because in our household, it was this food that really divided the household. And my mom would cook them and my dad would be mad at her for cooking them. And my sisters would, you know, turn up their noses and be siding with my dad about how awful they were. And so I would be my mom's companion while she cooked this food, and I ended up eating them with her, and it would always be like wintertime food, like once a year. And so I wrote it, and it's a food that people, when they know what they are, they have some response to what they are, and either they have a history loaded or whatever. It's just an emotionally charged food. And I read it there, and it got the most response that anything I'd ever written had ever gotten. And I'd been writing for a while, and it just gathered momentum. And afterwards, I got invited to submit it to a magazine, and the magazine published it. And then it was published in this Best Food Anthology, and then a textbook, like for middle school students, a multicultural textbook wanted to publish it, and then it was in another anthology, and it was just like the little engine that could, and it completely came out of left field, but it was fun, and it got me, you know, it brought attention to my work, and then, you know, people were saying, why don't you do this more, or do you want to write a book? Why don't you write a memoir that's a food memoir? And I didn't feel like I could do that, but I did feel like there's more to this, and maybe there's more to me doing more memoir. And so I got subsequent assignments that kept pulling different stories out. And so it feels now to me like there is a book, though the book keeps changing. So at first I thought it was a story about my growing up in Hyde Park and this generation gap between myself and my parents, and this geographical gap between myself and my parents and my sisters too, and all the misunderstandings and complications. But then it kept changing, and then I thought it was going to be more about, once I had Ella, more about this multi-generational story about place and a kind of a travelogue, and where did I grow up and my parents growing up in Jim Crow, and what do I want for Ella? And then it kept complicating, you know, when we got back here and my mom passed away. And so it keeps gathering these layers, and it feels more urgent actually. And it feels like it's still turning out to be this project about place, and about family, and about food, and about race. But it's a much different than what I thought it would be. And so I am pursuing that, but it's on the back burner right now because the oral history is the thing that has the deadline. And so I've also been working on this oral history of high-rise public housing, and it was something that I was just drawn to, and it caught in terms of there being interest and someone saying, okay, do it, or some people saying, okay, do it. But it came out of growing up in Chicago, living so close and yet so far away, you know, from Robert Taylor and Stateway Gardens in particular, and then seeing those buildings come down and wanting to know right away, like, where do the people go? And being really skeptical right away that there were necessarily happy endings that would be tied to the CHA's plan for transformation. And so that started out of a conversation with a friend who had edited and conducted several other oral histories for this series of Voice of Witness. And he was the one that said, you should do it. And he's from Chicago himself. And it gathered, and I've been at work at it now for the past in terms of researching and just figuring out the lay of the land and then talking to people, it's been about 2 years that I've been at work on that. So that's what's got to get to the station soon before the year's out. And then I see myself turning back to the memoir project, and then there are a couple of novels that are percolating also that I imagine in the next few years I'll finish.
How do you, with this public housing project, how have you contacted people or found out about their stories?
Yeah, it started very much word of mouth, where I still know a lot of people in Chicago, and I just let people know that I was doing this. And one friend knew a couple of people. Well, she knew one woman that she introduced me to. Some part of it just kind of gathered that way, where I let people know and people said, hey, I've got this friend, or I know this person. I also posted flyers. Like, I really want to include downstate, people who live downstate now. So in Urbana, I posted some flyers, and just in local social service office and libraries, did that at Chicago State here. And that also got the word out a little bit wider. And then I've met some activists, public housing activists who have connected me to people. One activist in particular, Jamie Calvin at the experimental station, has been really helpful in just not only introducing me to people, but helping me figure out what the story really requires. And talking to him led me to do some work teaching. Well, it was something I wanted to do, but it's put pressure on me to do it, to teach at Danville Prison. Because I knew that there are stories there. But as that's developed, it's clear that it's complicated, and I actually don't think I can get the story. I can't get the stories. They're these different, different sets of red tape. But
to interview the prisoners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
I can't imagine.
Yeah, nothing has been a straight line. And everything has been really great. I mean, I have to say that too. I ended up teaching there. I started last summer, so I've been teaching there for the past year. And it's opened up all these new questions and all these commitments that I feel that I really want to sustain. So it doesn't tie into the project the way I first thought it did, but it's really changed the course of what I want to be and do, and it's been really great.
So with the you mentioned earlier the story that got a little bit of attention,
mm-hmm.
and then people were saying, why don't you do more of this? Did you feel like you know, how did you feel about that? Was it something you were wanting to do, or maybe feeling like, wait, you're, you know, I don't want to be pigeonholed in this way, or has it grown on you over time, or how do you feel about that subject matter and then what people's excitement about it?
I had mixed reactions. I think I was initially gratified to write something that clearly struck a chord with people, and the exchange I had just the weekend of the symposium was more than I could have ever dreamt. I left it just high, you know, and this was when I was going through tenure stuff and like, will I get tenure? Will I not? But it didn't, over time, all of that kind of dissipated. And the reaction that I got from the piece and the exchange that emerged from that, it reminded me that this is what I'm in all of, you know, this is one reason why I'm doing this. And it just, it was great. It just felt like I told some kind of truth that really connected, and I felt like I risked something in the piece. I ended up writing about falling in love with this guy named Chad in the neighborhood, blonde, blue-eyed, and my, like, part of the story in the essay is my parents' reaction to that and their fear and their upset about me being in love with a white guy and the white guy being in love with me. And it felt really good to write something that felt risky, that connected. So in the process, I felt a little bit of trepidation because my mom was always one who, though she was the most voracious reader I've ever known, she always would say, don't write about me. Whatever you do, don't write about me. Don't write about me. Don't write about me. So as I was writing about her, I was thinking, ooh, I hope my mom doesn't, I hope my mom never reads this. And then it gathered speed. And so it just became this thing that actually was an occasion for us to have a confrontation about who I am as a writer and the fact that I was going to write about her. And so all of this stuff came out of it. My mom, of course, well, I shouldn't say of course, but when it first came out, there was interest from the Tribune. Donna Pierce had come and interviewed us, and my mom was like, no way, I don't want to be known as the Chitlin lady. You know, she was very Greta Garbo about, like, none of that. I don't want no pictures, no nothing. And so it was a process for us to get to a place where she said, okay, I'll be interviewed, and okay, I guess they can take my picture too. And so there was all of this stuff just between the two of us that happened around the piece becoming so public. And then once it got out, and there were a couple of agents, not like millions, but a couple of agents got in touch and said, I read this, do you have any work, and you have anything you can show? And that was really great. And then I had a conversation with an agent who said, would you write a food memoir? And that was a moment when I did feel like that might be forcing it. Like, at the time, it felt like to construct a whole memoir around food, it didn't feel, I just couldn't see how I could do it. It didn't feel like something that would be like organically my story, though I knew food would be part of a story I would tell, but like, you know, this is a chapter about Chitlins and this is my life through something else. That part didn't feel like something I could inhabit. And so I think that was probably the moment where I felt like, well, maybe this, I do want to keep doing this food writing, but I don't think I can plug into it in this way. But then when other things came up and I had other occasions to write and do it in more discreet, kind of just a magazine piece or another conference piece, that turned into the piece I read at Garlic and Greens, those snapshots, I enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed those as exercises. And in doing those, I started to feel like, well, maybe food, there's a way to do this that doesn't feel artificial, but it's just coming at food in these different ways as different jumping points, rather than like, okay, this is a chitlins chapter, or this is a, you know, macaroni and cheese chapter, or this is the chapter about my mom's shrimp Creole or something like that. It just, I enjoyed finding other ways to use food, like to tell my dad's migration story, or tell my dad's late, you know, work story, the different ways that he worked in service and worked with food, and how that kind of linked up with his passages. That felt like I was able to discover something in the process. So I don't know. Does that answer?
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So just for the purposes of this recording, mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the migration story that mm-hmm. you were mentioning?
Yeah, so the piece that I read, at least an excerpt, a good part of it I read at the Garlic and Greens, it came out of an assignment, again from Southern Foodways. They were having a field trip in Chicago, and it was focusing on Chicago as an up south city, and you know, as this great migration city. And John T. Edge, who is the director of the symposium, or of the Alliance, got in touch and said, we're having this field trip. Can you write something, you know, with Chicago as an up south city in mind? And I said yes before I could even think of what I would do. And then I thought about my dad. I felt like, okay, this time, since my mom's still kind of mad at me, I'll write about my dad. And I decided to interview him, because one thing I realized with both of my parents is there's a lot that I still didn't know about their youth and about their life before I existed, or even when I was young. I really wanted to know who they were a lot more. And so I started writing this novel that was set in a coal mining town in Alabama. My dad went with me on a trip to Alabama. It was great. And I felt like I wanted to follow up on that, to ask my dad more questions and get it down, you know. And I started thinking about the fact that he had worked his way through his early life by working in kitchens, by, you know, short order cook, by doing this. I always thought the migration work was really interesting, that he'd gone north before he'd actually moved north, that he had come up to Wisconsin and also Michigan, and he'd mentioned that here and there, but we never got into it. And so once I figured out, okay, this is what I want to do, and I thought of Alice Walker's In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, this essay she wrote, it was really an inspiration, and I thought, okay, In Search of My Father's Kitchens, I knew that was going to be the title pretty quickly once I sat down. And then I just interviewed him and thought about how to string the chronology, string the narrative together. And we met over a meal in Urbana, took my parents out, and my mom, though she always pretended to be the reluctant subject, of course, was like she taking over the interview and telling her stories, and they, of course, they collaborated on some stories about their early marriage and moving to Chicago together. And so that was really my first time, I think, ever interviewing anybody, you know, like I'm gonna do this with a tape recorder and all of that. So that happened, and I wrote the piece and shared it at the field trip, and then I decided to send it into a literary magazine, and they accepted it, and so it became something in between two covers, which was really nice.
So what is the story of your father's
migrations? Well,
in summary,
he was born in a coal mining town in Alabama. He had grandparents in Columbus, Mississippi, so he actually moved between those places. There was a long time that he lived, a couple years he lived on the farm in Columbus. So his first experiences with food and sort of working with food were when he was living in Columbus. His grandparents had a farm. He worked the farm with his cousins and with a couple of his siblings. It was a big farm, so they had orchards, they had cotton. I think they had cotton. I think they did. I know they picked cotton somewhere, but they had orchards. It was, they had all kinds of stuff that they harvested. So he knew that as a boy, and I include that toward the end of that essay, just a little bit, very little bit. But it started there. Then in the coal mining town, he worked in a diner, and then he went to junior college in Selma, Alabama, and he worked in this dining room at a country club and earned money to go to college, and then he went to Talladega, four-year college, and then I think it was the summer before he started Talladega that he came north to pick peas on this farm in Wisconsin. At the end of that summer, he went further north, he went to Michigan to pick cherries, and he worked with a lot of Mexican families who were migrant workers, and they ran out of work for him, and so he came back south earlier than he wanted to. And then he finished college. Then he joined the military, was in the reserves. Then he came back to Chicago and he worked in a kitchen at Kraft. There was a Kraft plant that was on the drive. If you take the Lakeshore Drive north, there was like a Kraft plant that was like just to the west of where Navy Pier is, kind of. There used to be a different kind of, they called it an S-curve. And you could see it from the S-curve. It doesn't exist anymore. But there was a Kraft like plant there, and he worked in the kitchen, and that's how he made money. And he also worked delivering flowers, and eventually he got a job with the government working for the FDA for Food and Drug Administration, and he worked in a government lab, and they devised these different foods that were rations for the military. And I always thought they were space food, but I think I was really wrong about that. But they were rations, so that was another way he worked with food. And then he ended up being an investigator for the FDA, so he would go places and inspect plants. And so I think that probably covers every base about the food thing. But it's kind of wild just to think about different ways that working with food and serving people in all these different capacities really stitched his life together and really like propelled him. And so he worked, that's the way he spent his career, was then working for the FDA, and he had a badge, and we always thought that was weird and kind of cool. And he still cooks like a short order cook, so he is the breakfast guy in our house, and he just got these ways of doing things that I've always been fascinated with and found really efficient. And
what's one of the ways, or one of the things he does that is,
it's a way that he keeps lots of things going. It's not even a it's not necessarily a technique, but it's a way that he can just manage a lot of things at once and make sure everything's hot at the same time. That I guess I probably learned something by watching him for so long. But as a kid, I thought, wow, I don't even think I always knew that he was a short order cook, but I noticed that he liked doing that, and that he was the breakfast man.
What's your father's name?
His name is Joe Louis Petty. He was named after Joe Louis, the fighter.
And did you learn how to cook when you were growing up, or did you just watch, or how would you describe that
process? I watched. And really, I watched my mom more than I watched my dad, because she was the one who did most of the cooking. And she would have us chop things and give us raw cabbage and carrots and things to sort of, as we helped her, but also to like keep us at length if she needed like to do, you know, get things done with us, not always under heel. But I watched her cook a lot and bake a lot. And and I helped her in small ways. I don't think I was a major force in her meal production, but I like to help her out, just doing small things. And when there was a cake to bake, I really liked being around for that. So, yeah. So never anything formal. Just watching.
Do you have some siblings then?
I have two sisters, and I'm the middle of the three. Yeah.
Where do they live?
They are now in Chicago. My younger sister just moved here from New Jersey about a week ago. Yeah. And my older sister, my younger sister's north, and my older sister's a couple of blocks from here, and she moved here from, she had been previous to Chicago. She lived in Boston for a long time, and then they'd been in Alabama right before they moved to Chicago. So she moved here last fall. When my mom's illness got worse, they were in transition, and they decided to get here. So they've been here for almost a year.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really great.
So of the three of you, who is the most interested in cooking or baking?
I am. I'd say my older sister is not at all interested in. Her husband cooks, and he does all the food stuff. My younger sister, Miriam, she's into it, and she's good at it. She's a lot more precise than I am as a cook. But I'd say we're probably neck and neck in terms of interest. But yeah, I think being part of the Southern Food Ways and coming to Symposium and meeting other people who are much better at cooking than I am has made me increasingly interested in trying different things and learning, you know, being more of a student than I used to be.
So, one of the classic garlic and greens questions is asking people what's a favorite home cooked dish that's a tradition in your family, mm-hmm. and how would you describe its preparation?
Mm. Oh gosh.
You can take a minute to consider it. Or maybe there's more than one.
Yeah, there are a few. I mean, when I think of the favorites, I think of what my mom cooked well, honestly. And, you know, and she cooked so many things well, but I really loved her fried fish. And I think that's something, like, she fried all kinds of fish, but catfish is the one that was sort of consistently over time. She'd do whitefish and catfish. She made really great collard greens, and so I've learned how to make those in a slightly different way. But I'd say collards, when I think about meal that she would make that I love, would be fresh tomatoes, catfish, fried catfish with cornmeal breading, and collard greens. But she made great red beans, and I think of that as a real, like, comfort food, red beans and rice. And she grew up in southern Arkansas, not far from Louisiana, so I think there's some things with red rice, like rice was very big in her diet and growing up, and so we'd have a lot of things with rice in our house. I realized it was because of that. So red beans and rice, and she'd make a shrimp creole, and always black-eyed peas with rice, and just rice was real big, and that was her signature.
So how did she come to live in Chicago?
She was a career musician and music teacher, and right after she graduated from college, she taught in Florida for maybe a year or two, and then she and my dad got engaged, and I don't know why Chicago. I mean, my father had family here, so I guess that was a big reason why. A couple of siblings here, but they moved to Chicago when they got married. And so they were married for 50 years. So they've lived here a long time.
And so you and your siblings were all born here.
Mm-hmm. We were.
They were Chicagoans.
Yeah. Southsiders, yeah. Yes.
So where was your house or apartment growing up?
The first place I lived was in Chatham Village, so 83rd Street off of Cottage Grove, 83rd and Langley. And it's a lot of bungalows around there. Like if you go down Stony, like, and we then moved to Hyde Park when I was 7, and we lived in this little townhouse that is now right behind the racquetball club. But at the time we moved there, there was no club. There was just a wild field, a field of like wild grass and flowers between our townhouse and then 47th Street was like right beyond the field. And that's where my dad still lives.
So you can go visit.
Yeah, it is. It's really nice. It's really nice.
Does he do any cooking these days?
He does. He still, you know, if I'm there, if I come in the morning, he'll make breakfast. And grits are usually a part of breakfast and eggs. And then he'll make, he's doing more fish. He's like broiling. He's watching his diet because he's had high cholesterol. And with my mom's illness, I think it put him in a shakier place in terms of his own health. And so he's been more dedicated and disciplined about broiling stuff and eating. He started eating a lot of broccoli a long time ago, and he has broccoli every day now, I think. But he'll make, you know, broccoli and asparagus and spinach. Those are his biggies. And then if I'll make collards, I'll bring food over and bring him a plate when I cook, or he comes over here for dinner too. So we have a lot more fish in our lives than we used to, and I think that's been good for us all, and not fried all the time.
Well, but about this catfish, imagine there was an alien who came from outer space and had no idea what to do with catfish. How would you describe the steps?
Process.
I mean, of course, you don't have to say like precise ingredients.
But yeah.
What is that process for that you observe with your mom?
Yeah. Well, she would go to a fish market that was here called Jesselsland. It exists no more. There's a Pepe's Tacos there now. And she would usually get her fish there, and they would fillet it. But I think I'd seen her bring a whole fish home, and she knew how to dress it and prepare it also. And catfish really involved simple ingredients: cornmeal, salt and pepper, some paprika, dredging it, and then peanut oil in a cast iron skillet. Get the oil really hot, and then fry the fish on both sides till it's brown. Yeah, that was her recipe. Very basic. No liquid, anything. Just cornmeal, salt, pepper, and paprika.
So there's nothing to stick the cornmeal to the catfish. Just the moisture of the fish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I have to ask you the other garlic and greens question, which I hadn't been asking at first, but when I was talking to some of the youth, mm-hmm. I've been volunteering at the Green Youth Farm. That's mm-hmm. That was at Revis Elementary this
mm-hmm.
summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just was talking to these kids. They're all like 10, 11, 12 years old. And it was really a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to this question, which is very basic, but it was very important. Asking them, and I'm going to ask you, how would you define soul food?
I guess I would define it as African American, in the way that I know it's a working definition. I would say that it is a working definition. It's not something that I feel is hard and fast at all. But in terms of my associations with it, I guess I'll start from there first. Like I've always, in hearing that term growing up, in being in conversations about that term as an adult, I see it as food that comes out of an African American tradition, and that it comes out of a tradition. I guess that's the thing. I see it as something that goes back generations, and that there is a legacy that has a tie back to, the arrival of Africans in the United States. And I see it as a hybrid kind of food that has many influences, and some, you know, that trace back to West Africa, some that reflect interactions and influences from European traditions. I think it was rooted in an experience of slavery in the U.S., and that it's moved forward and changed and evolved, but I think it comes from there. And I guess, I mean, I think the evolution point is really key, because I feel like I cook a different kind of collards than my mom cooked. But I still see it as being tied to her and tied back to other generations. But I also know from going to SFA events that, you know, there are these thin lines between, okay, this is soul food and this is Southern food, and there's shared traditions between Black folks and white folks down south, and it's not so easy just to claim that it belongs to one, you know, it belongs in one kitchen and no one else has any kind of tire experience or has any kind of adaptation. But I know that's a complicated answer, but I guess I think it is a complicated question.
Yeah, it's a complicated concept if we really look at it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So when I thought to ask it, then I thought, oh, this is actually it gets to the heart of a lot of the questions in the project itself.
Yeah, it does. It really does. Yeah.
How would you say you said there was an evolution from your mother's greens to your version of it?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is different?
My greens I don't cook them as long as my mom did. I think it wasn't even that I didn't want to cook her greens. It was more like I didn't have enough time and I wanted to be able to cook things, you know, on the spot with Ella, 2-3 years old. Like, I knew once I got living in Urbana, there was all of this great local produce. And so once I got my hands on fresh collards that were being grown by my friends and around me, I was like, okay, now's the time for me to, like, do this thing. And collards were easy to wash as opposed to other greens my mom used to make that were, like, she always complained that mustards were so hard. I think mustards were so hard to clean. Or turnips, too. Anyway, but my mom's took longer to cook. My mom started usually with salt pork or something, and then slow cooked them with the salt pork at the base. Mine, I use more onion. I use sometimes I'll use some bacon, but a little bit of bacon fat as like a starter to saute onion. And put a little vinegar in, and basically I can cook it, you know, with like prep it and do it within an hour. And my mom's was more like the pot food that, you know, she would slow simmer and we, you know, eat a few hours later. So different base and different cooking time. But my mom liked to really, she always liked to start with fresh ingredients. She really didn't like to use frozen produce, though she would in a pinch. But I still see her with the, you know, greens in the sink, whether they were collards or turnips or mustards. She liked to get the stuff fresh.
Have you ever done any gardening?
I have in Urbana for way too short a period, but a friend of mine, a neighbor, said, you guys have enough, you know, you have enough land here, you could grow some things. And so he came one day and dug up this plot right near where, well, right alongside our garage, and we grew some things, kale and herbs and a couple of strawberries and greens and salad greens. And it was great. And it was at a moment like when my mom was ill, and it just felt like such a, it was a really therapeutic experience to plant something right then and to watch it come up and to bring it in. And I love kale, so it was nice to have my own. And my mom used to keep a garden, so I still think about maybe doing that at my parents' house because there's some space out there I can take advantage of.
Well, you were part of this event in early August, mm-hmm. so we before we started recording, you mentioned the event, and you were talking about. Well, I guess what I want to ask you is, how would you describe it, and what did you get out of it as a participant?
I felt like it was a really good conversation. What Mr. Black offered, what Dara offered, what I offered, I felt like we were coming in with our different pieces, but pieces that organically were tied together around traditions and survival and progress too. And I felt like those of what we, and you know, it just happened. I mean, I know you, I shouldn't say that, you were the curator. To me, it felt very organic and spontaneous because I didn't know what they were going to do. But it was great to hear what they offered, really great to hear what Timuel Black had to say about Chicago in an era that I'm still really hungry and curious to know about. And what Dara offered about Fresh Moves was really inspiring and just gave me a different sense of the city now and what's going on, the possibilities here. And I was inspired by them both. And then the conversation that came out of that with Vincent moderating with people coming in and having their observations and questions to share, it felt really communal. It didn't feel like I'm standing here and people are there and Tim and Dara are here. It was a communal experience and a really rich exchange, I thought.
Thank you. Well, I'm really glad you were a part of it.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I had a blast and I convinced my dad to come and I think he was a little bit embarrassed to be the topic of anything I was reading, but I think he enjoyed it too.
So. What did he say afterwards?
He said, you did good. That was the first thing he said. And then he said, I didn't know you were going to be reading that piece. I thought you were reading the piece about your mother. And then I said, no, Daddy, I warned you. I really did try to give him a heads up, but I think he wasn't paying attention or something. So he was a little bit surprised. But he said, I didn't know you were paying that much attention when you were asking me those questions. So I think that pleased him too, to know that I actually was paying attention. So that was nice. And my mom, I think I mentioned when you and I first met, she taught at Diet for many years. And as kids, my dad used to take us to events at DuSable. There used to be oratorical contests and all these different events. So it was really, really lovely and like poignant to be there as a grown person and remembering my parents was really, it just felt really nice too.
So what are some things you want to pass on to your daughter about mm-hmm. your parents' life and the food traditions or anything like that? Well, that's a lot.
But. Yeah. I mean, I want her to know the South. And we just got back from Tuskegee, where we saw Maurice's great uncle, who I wrote about in the piece, who's now 97. And I really want her to know the South, maybe more than I knew the South growing up, because I think I came into an awareness of how so many things I did and said and ate were tied to the South. And so I'd like her to have an active relationship with the South as it is now, but also to take her places where my parents were and to tell her about as it was then. And I want her to, you know, she's at the age where she's still really picky, at the stage where, like, there are five things she'll eat. So when you talk about food, and I think about her and food, it's very, I know I'm kind of, like, warped right now because I just want her to eat. But I think, you know, I want her to eat well. I want her to eat widely. I want her to know how to, I want her to be inventive and know how to think creatively about food and to be healthy. And so, you know, I don't, she's barely, the piece I wrote for Oxford American was about her first Southern meal, which was this peach. And I feel like that's still her relationship with Southern food is more like at the elemental level. Like she hasn't had like a throwdown, like anything as far as some big feast is concerned. But, you know, I think that's okay. I think that the Oxford American piece really sort of helped me understand what I do want to pass on to her. And so it's not necessarily like this recipe or that recipe, but like a deeper awareness of the landscape and the history and how things connect.
And how old is she again?
She's 3.5. Yeah, 3.5.
Still have a lot of time left before a full palate.
I'm counting on it.
Well, I was just reading this article in the New York Times about how there's this, you know, migration back to the South.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you have any experience with that with your friends or colleagues or
heading back south.
Well, you said your sister moved here.
She did. And so my sister, well, actually, the funny thing is both of my sisters have lived in the South. My younger sister went to graduate school in Atlanta, so she ended up living there for 6 or 7 years. My sister Jill was in Alabama just for about a little bit over a year. And I used to spend a couple of summers in Mississippi. I had friends who lived there. And so I made excuses to get there over summers when I wasn't teaching. And I think I went there really wanting to get to know the landscape better and wanting that kind of contact. And also just feeling at home and having this opportunity to make deeper connections and being there. So my sisters have moved south. And I always said, and I've said to Maurice, that eventually I'd like to move south. And we're still like in conversation about that because he's not as stoked as I am to do it. But I do feel that pull. I do feel that draw to be there and to live there. I guess amongst my peers, I don't think I know anyone who's done the reverse migration, though some of the people, like neighbors and like aunts and uncle types, not people who were in my family, but people who lived near us and we knew well. A couple of families that I knew did move back south. I'm thinking of one family in particular, moved from Hyde Park back to North Carolina. But we didn't keep up with like what happened, what their experience was afterwards.
Well, is there anything I haven't asked that you would like to add? We've covered a lot of topics.
Yeah, we have. No, I think that does. I knew I wanted to say that part about mom and diet just because I thought that was really cool. That was like part of your constellation was this place that was so important to her. But no, I think I said my piece.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school, my first school was John T. Peary, and that was in Chatham. And then I went to school in the neighborhood, so I went to Shoesmith and to Lewis Worth and to Kinlit, all within like a stone's throw of each other.
How would you say, you know, what is the most striking difference about the neighborhood now than when you were growing up?
It was not a tourist destination. So that still surprises me to see, like, all the tourist trolleys and buses and people with cameras and, you know, that is so much about Obama. And it also was, I remember it as a more, like, shabby, I mean, I don't mean that at all in a derogatory way. There were these big houses. I didn't live in a big house, you know, but I knew people who lived in these big houses, and they were more like Pippi Longstocking houses than Tuck Pointed, like To the Max, and like these showcases. And so that's been a really interesting part of being back too, is like, whoa, was that there before? Because, you know, there are things, there are these landmarks that are still here, but there's a different gloss. That I don't think there was that gloss when I was a kid. But it's very, in many ways, it feels as I remember it. There's a lot about it that feels familiar, so it's not day and night.
You know, I passed this, this guard car a lot on this road, mm-hmm. but I still haven't figured out where Obama's house is.
Okay.
But, because I always think, oh, it's just this one block they're guarding. Where is yeah. this place?
Yeah.
Like, I've been inside of that synagogue because there was a green movement event there about a year
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, there's a lot of gardening going out right in
yes,
front.
Yes, they have, it's Angelic Organics has a, they're trying to run a community garden type
okay.
thing there.
Okay.
So that's who was hosting the, well, I think I went to a couple of things there.
Okay.
Anyway, so I went in there and I thought, where am I? What are they guarding here? I don't know. Maybe
it
I'm
was
totally
right cool. across the street.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so you get to, if you go this way, there'll be the synagogue, and then directly across the street, there's like, there's some hedges and lawn and stuff that get in the way, but that first house off of Hyde Park Boulevard is the Obama house.
I saw it. I just didn't know what I was looking at.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I remember I was with an architect friend who says she was working on one of the houses, but it wasn't the Obama house. So I think I was, you know, I was like, yeah, these are nice houses. But she mm-hmm. didn't like make a point of saying, we're right next to mm-hmm. the Obama house.
That's the place. That's the place. Yeah.
Well, now you're neighbors.
Yeah, for the moment.
Well, it's a good spot.
It is a good spot. It's been so good to us, and you know, we're attached to it. We were looking for a place to land, and now it feels like a really good place to be. So you got lucky.
Well, I hope you get to stick around.
Thank you.
It's comfortable, then you should.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions for me?
Well, I'm curious about this. So this is going to be part of an archive then?
Well, I'm not sure who wants to host the archive.
Okay.
Although that is my idea. Mm-hmm. I'm planning to talk to someone at the Hull House because they have this, you know, they're really interested in the history of not just the, you know, immigrants from other countries, but like they're... I went on a tour for educators there, and it just seemed like their mm-hmm. mission was so multifaceted now mm-hmm. of how to explore the Jane, you know, the legacy there. Mm-hmm. So I think they might be interested in like having an archive, but I don't know who will want to access it.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of what I'm trying to do now is with like the short term is mm-hmm. that through the different interviews, I'm going to pull out different quotes or vignettes or stories, and the book will illustrate those in a mm-hmm. way. And mm-hmm. so it won't actually be like oral history in the traditional sense of like a more long
sure.
or narrative, but
sure.
Highlighting different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
having a breadth of people from different backgrounds and different experiences has really been important to
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have some good things already. Mm-hmm. And part of me gets really into the process, and I'm like, okay, at what point do I stop? Because
yeah.
there's so many people you could talk to, and
yeah.
everybody's story is important. That's what I feel, and then mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, but at some point I have to just keep
yeah.
moving forward.
I,
so.
I, I appreciate the challenge of that. I really do.
Yeah.
I really do.
It's good that you have a publisher with a deadline.
That does help. It does help. I mean, there's a definite, like, yeah, arrival time or departure time. So that's made a good pressure and, like, a framework that I'll have to keep in mind.
Is there anyone in particular that you would recommend to me? I'm not actively looking for anyone at the moment to do a next interview, but for example, someone you think I should definitely talk to because of who they are,
mm-hmm.
what you know about them.
Oh, goodness. I feel like they're like faces crowding my head right now with that question. I feel, you know, I'm thinking of family members. I mean, I'm thinking of neighbors.
There's lots of people.
There are. I mean, I'm trying to now think of someone I know, like, if you call them, they will be, you know, that they'll be like, okay, rather than you know, you have to do, like, a
right.
heavy, like, search and lobby thing.
Well, or you could mention it to them before I give them a call, and they would be like, okay, you're that girl.
Yeah.
Tape recorded. Audrey told me.
Yeah, that. No, I'd be glad to. Actually, what I want to do is, I want to think about it, because I probably
sure.
will come up with more than one name for
yeah,
you, and then
great.
I can email you, and also talk to Mo, and he may
okay.
have some suggestions.
Yeah,
too.
At the moment, you know, I'm not, I want to increase the breadth of what I have, but I also don't have, the funny thing about my project is there's so many people who could contribute to it, and
yeah.
I want to have all of that,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, so I think
okay.
it's important not to, you know, everyone I talk to, I ask that question, do you want to recommend someone
yeah.
else to me?
Yeah, yeah.
But no pressure.
Okay, no, I understand, none felt. I mean, I actually, I'm now thinking of this guy that I'd gotten to know through Southern Foodways. His name is Paul Frigia. I think that's his last name. He has a small company, and he specializes in Southern Foodways for it. So I think they make cornbread mix. He would just be one person who I think would be really interesting. I mean, just given his angle, and he lives in Hyde Park. I think he would have a lot of interesting, I mean, not that other people don't, but I just think he would be a really,
yeah, I haven't really talked to any business owners, so that's nice.
He might be, yeah.
I did a group interview with some seniors at this place called the Renaissance Collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really fun, and I might go back and talk to some of them individually,
because mm-hmm.
we were kind of sitting around the table.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked having, you know, because I worked with the youth before, and then the elders have, you know, a lot more in-depth
oh, yeah.
stories.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I think.
That's what I'm thinking about now, because the kids were fun, but it's also not, you know, they're not as in touch with their
mm-hmm.
own history yet,
yeah.
so like in terms of their families.
Yeah.
But I think it was really, like, they were doing all this gardening and
mm-hmm.
growing all this stuff, so it was nice to talk to them about
that's really cool.
stuff.
Now, if I recommended family, would that be nepotistic, or would you
oh,
be
I don't mind.
Okay.
I think this is all about family.
Okay.
Today, so I think that's totally fine with me.
Okay. Because
yeah.
I think my dad, given all of his farming, I mean, there's. I feel like my interviews, I've just barely scratched the surface, so I know he'd have.
Yeah.
He's got a lot to.
No, that would be great.
To share.
He sounds wonderful. Like, you know, he has such a rich life experience that.
He does.
I'd love to hear about.
All right, I will.
And
you
would have a recording. He asks questions
yeah,
that you. I might ask questions that you might not. So.
Exactly.
You can,
exactly.
You can feed me some questions that you want.
I will mention it to him.
All
right. Away, and then I'll also figure out Paul's name.
Sure.
and talk to Mo. But yeah, for sure, I can recommend people.
All right, I'm going to turn.